Hall. The banquet will be served at 7:30, which is when the first bombs are due to explode. I'll be watching the clock, and 4 minutes before, at 7:26, I will receive a blank call. We'll be in the main hall, which is large. The bombs have been installed within the walls at the furthest end of the room from the door. We'll use the blank call as an excuse to stand by the exit on the opposite corner of the explosives. I'll tell them that your aunt, who is sick, has called, and you need to take a few minutes to talk to her. I'll accompany you to the door, where we'll hold an imaginary conversation in view of everyone. Then, as soon as the bombs go off, you'll rush to the Eggs lab using the staircase, while I'll head off in a different direction to arrange transport for us. I listened carefully as he began to explain how to set up the bombs around the glass casing of the egg, and have them implode without blowing myself up. He made me repeat the process 3 times until he was satisfied that every detail had sunk in, though I would have appreciated a practice run. "Then," he went on, "all you have to do is retrieve the egg, hurry to the stairs, and head up to the roof. You will find the door leading out to the rooftop open, and I'll be waiting for you there. From the time you leave me downstairs, you have exactly 15 minutes. You mustn't be any later than that." 15 minutes was tight for all that. The light fitting hiding the package was fiddly. At least I'd opened it once already. I had to hope the second time wouldn't take me as long. "So," Lee said, clasping his hands together, "that's all you have to do. Alistair is due to call to check in on us in about 15 minutes. And we'll make the call to Vigo in an hour." I sat in the kitchen opposite Lee, clutching his phone in my hands and staring down at Vigo's number. I pressed dial. My palms grew sweaty as it rang. "Mr. Bertrand?" Vigo's deep voice spoke in my ear after 5 rings. "Mrs. Bertrand," I replied. Vigo went quiet. So did I. Lee widened his eyes at me. "I'm sorry to disturb you," I said, wetting my lower lip, "but I needed to talk to you about last night." There was a beat before he replied, "I'm not sure that's a good idea." "It probably isn't," I said, "but I need to speak to you. I'll be at the lab's banquet with Lee tonight. I need to get something off my chest."
"Where is your husband now?"
"Taking the dog for a walk. He's off work today."
"Then why can't you tell me now?" Vigo posed.
"It's something best said in person." Another span of silence. Then I heard him drawing a breath.
"All right," he muttered. "I'll meet you. But after that, I think it's best that we don't see each other again. I doubt your husband will ask me to have a lot more to do with you."
"Okay," I said, my voice going a tad scratchy.
"Where do you want to meet?"
"In the lab building, outside the camera room."
Okay.
"At 7:15. I'll do my best to arrive at that time. But if I have some trouble getting away from Lee, could you wait for up to 30 minutes? If I don't arrive by 7:45, feel free to leave." Asking anybody to hang around for 30 minutes was disrespectful. I could hear his reluctance. But he agreed. He was probably regretting ever having gotten involved with me in the first place. "Okay, I'll see you later," I concluded. "Goodbye, Vigo."
"Goodbye, Mrs. Bertrand."
Chapter 33. Lee was pleased by my performance.
"Now you can relax for the next few hours," he said. "We will be leaving here at 5:30 to allow us some leeway with the traffic. But I suggest you get ready in good time. And wear something nice."
I wish that we didn't have hours to wait. I wish that we could leave now and get it all over with. But the time passed quickly. Before I knew it, I was in my room getting ready. I chose the same blue dress that I had worn for Lee's and my wedding. When I ran, I would have to hike it up, but the only thing suitable for an occasion such as a banquet would be a long dress, according to Lee. I would wear my heels, too. Those would definitely have to come off. After I finished dressing and trying to make my hair look presentable, I left my room and found Lee sitting at his computer again. He was already dressed in a black tuxedo. His hair was gelled back,
his face clean-shaven. He looked bland, nondescript, the polar opposite of Vigo's rugged style. He looked me over as I eyed him, then reached into a drawer and handed me the same pack of tools that I'd used the last time I'd ventured into the Egg's lab. Screwdrivers for the light fitting. He also retrieved a small lady's handbag and gave it to me. Got this for you in anticipation. I couldn't quite bring myself to say thanks. I took the bag from him and stuffed the tools into it. Lee returned his focus to the screen. "We still have about 15 minutes before we're due to leave," he said. "Vigo is there." He pointed to a red dot near Crescent River. I couldn't find the other four dots, though. I spotted my own. I hadn't questioned Lee about the tracker he'd given me, and he hadn't mentioned it either. There wasn't much to say, given that I'd be dead by now if he hadn't thought to do it. Lee shut down the map. "We won't need this after tonight," he said. "I'm going to be uninstalling it from my system and wiping all traces of it." After he'd finished getting rid of the map, we headed downstairs. "I've called a car service," he explained as he led me out of the house. It was a warm evening, a clear sky streaked with hues of orange. A shiny black vehicle rolled up on the gravel 5 minutes later. The chauffeur got out to let us into the back of the car. As we drove off, I glanced back at Lee's pyramid house. It was strange to think that this would be the last time I ever laid eyes on it. My sanctuary since I'd arrived. I felt a dull tug of guilt that I hadn't bidden farewell to Samuel. Even though it was rush hour, the journey went quickly. Time seemed to have sped up, and I was grateful for it. Soon the car was drawing into the parking lot of the laboratory, and Lee was helping me out. I checked my watch. 6:28. Entering the building's reception, I could hear the sound of male chatter. Lee led me past the lobby, along a corridor, and into the same lounge I had visited during my first trip to the lab. Extra seating had been placed in here, along with two extra billiards tables. The room was packed. I spotted a couple of familiar faces from my first visit, Simon and then Richard, Lee's boss. It was as my eyes fell on the ladder that I realized I wasn't the only woman here. There were two other wives, both apparently belonging to Richard, a blonde and a brunette, wearing tightly fitted gowns, teetering heels, and long earrings that tangled with their curly hair. They didn't look much older than me. They stood on either side of him, clutching his arms. I looked away as they caught my eye. Lee began to mingle with the crowd, introducing me to people as we passed. My mind was too distant to retain names. I merely smiled and nodded my head politely, which was all they expected from me anyway. I kept glancing at my watch as Lee engaged in conversation. At 6:45, Lee made his way with me over to an empty snack table as an excuse to get a bit of breathing, or rather, talking space. "You heard what Simon said?" he asked me beneath his breath as he popped a salt-encrusted nut into his mouth. "No?" I wasn't able to concentrate on the conversations. "He said King Maxon confirmed his plan to come. He's expected at 7:10, about the time we're due to head into the banquet hall." 5 minutes before Vigo. "So does that change anything?" I murmured. "We just have to hope he's not late." We returned to the sofas. The next 25 minutes slipped away in a blur of dark-colored suits and jovial chatter. As 7:10 drew in, the room became noticeably quieter, everyone anticipating the king's arrival. Then a man poked his head through the door to announce that the king would be delayed by 5 minutes. Lee's face notably tightened at the information. That would give everyone 10 minutes to settle into the banquet hall before the bombs imploded at 1:30. Assuming King Maxon didn't arrive even later, the banquet wouldn't start without him. If the bombs went off before we made it to the hall, they would still cause a distraction, of course, but Lee and I wouldn't be able to slip away so easily and discreetly to do what we needed to do. But none of this worry was necessary. At 7:16, the same man who'd come to announce King Maxon's lateness returned to announce his arrival. About a minute later, a tall, broad-shouldered man wearing a light gray, almost silvery, suit appeared in the doorway. He had thick, sandy brown hair that extended to his jawline, which sported an immaculately groomed goatee. Clutched in his right hand was some kind of walking stick, though to call it that would be an injustice. It looked more like a scepter, forged of what appeared to be solid silver, its rounded clutch engraved with gold. Behind him stood two burly-looking men who hardly fit into their straight tuxedos. Bodyguards, no doubt. A smile peeled across King Maxon's face, flashing a set of pearly white teeth. I had seen his picture before, but it was quite a different experience meeting him in the flesh. I could understand why people called him charismatic. There was an energy he brought to a room. "Gentlemen," he said, his voice smooth and deep, "I do apologize for keeping you waiting. Apparently even the king is susceptible to rush hour in Petrus City." Chuckles swept around the room. "Shall we proceed to the hall?" he posed. Everybody who had been seated rose immediately and bowed. The king turned and headed down the hallway with his bodyguards, while the rest of us filed after him. The banquet hall was several doors along, and the aroma of food filled my nostrils as we entered. The hall contained a huge table spanning the entire length of the room. Shiny steel warmers and platters were already laid out down the middle of the table, along with plates and cutlery. I pitied the man who ended up at the opposite end of the table. It was so close to the furthest wall. That person ended up being Richard. His two wives seated themselves on either side of him, while King Maxon sat at the head on the opposite end, his bodyguards occupying the chairs immediately next to him. The rest of us chose our seats. Everybody was obviously hungry. We were all seated and settled by 7:20, leaving us 10 minutes. The king rose to his feet. He didn't need to tap a glass to call for silence. Everyone's eyes were already fixed on him. He beamed around the table. "I am delighted to be here for this momentous occasion. More than anything, tonight is a celebration of you fine gentlemen. With your intelligence and determination, we have made progress this year. Many predicted impossible. It is you who are the building blocks of our society. You are the future. The lives of our future generations are in your hands. This year, you have all demonstrated that you are fully capable of bearing such a responsibility, and I anticipate you will do your nation proud for years to come. Thank you for your service to mankind." Everybody clapped. The king, raising his glass, sat down. "Now, let us feast!" His speech hadn't lasted long. It was 7:24 now. Dinner was supposed to be served early. Servers piled into the room and began to assist the guests in laying appetizers on their plates. And then, Lee's phone went off. Now, 7:26. Lee pulled the phone from his pocket, making a show of embarrassment. "Violet, it's your aunt. She couldn't have called at a worse time." He turned to Simon, who sat on the other side of him, apologetically, as well as the other men looking our way. "Excuse us for a minute." Lee betrayed his nerves as he gripped my hand far more firmly than necessary to lead me toward the exit. We stopped at the door, still in clear view of everyone, where he accepted the call and handed me the phone. "Are you out of the hospital yet?" I asked my imaginary aunt. "Oh, since when? Did you ask the doctor about that?" My heart was in my throat as I spent the next minute conversing with myself, then 2 minutes, then 3 minutes, and then came the blast. I felt the heat as Lee jerked me through the doors and out of the room. Shouts and screams erupted amidst the explosion, chilling me to the bone. Lee raced faster down the hallway than I thought him capable of. I yanked off my heels and strapped them to an arm in order to keep up. We reached the reception area. Now it was time to part ways. Lee pointed to the stairwell, and I darted for it, not even checking to see which direction Lee headed in. I didn't have a split second to waste. I had only 15 minutes to blow open the casing around the egg and then reach the roof. I raced up the stairway as fast as my legs could carry me. By the time I'd reached the top, I had burned through almost 2 minutes. Panting, I raced along the corridor to the egg room. I stopped outside it, staring at the closed door. Crap! Before, I'd had to page Lee for it to open, but now, I stopped panicking as I pushed at the door. It was already open. Of course Lee had thought of this. Emerging in the familiar lab, I hurried across the room toward the egg. I stood on the nearest table beneath the light fitting and, reaching into the small handbag that had remained hanging from my arm since I left the taxi, I drew out the stools. My hands were shaking as I began to work on the screws. Even though I was several floors up, I could hear the noise from below. Lock it out. Focus. I loosened the first bolt, then the second and third, until I arrived at the last one. I quickly realized that I had made a grave mistake when replacing this fitting last time. The teeth of the screws were damaged, chipped, which meant that none of my tools would gain a grip on it, and I had no leverage to open it. But I had already opened the other successfully, inserting my fingers at the edge of the fitting. I pulled downward and managed to create a gap large enough to fit a hand through. I felt for the package and found it where I'd left it. Gripping it, I coaxed it out, pressing downward against the fitting to make the gap wider. As I slipped it through, the edge of the fitting must have been too sharp, and it caused a tear in the foil package. Two small red cylinders fell to the floor. I leaped off the table and scooped them up, praying that they hadn't been damaged. I planted them on the table where I emptied the rest of the bag's contents. There were 5 red cylinders altogether. A wire that split into 5 at one end, with a black button-like object at the other, and a small black device with a round red button in the center of it. The activator. I checked my watch. 8 minutes. I can do this. Recalling Lee's detailed instructions, I began to set up the bomb. Each cylinder contained a sticky pad, which allowed it to attach to the glass around the egg. Then I clipped the split wire into the ends of each of the cylinders before switching on a button at the base. It began to flash. I took the activator in my hands and pressed a switch on this one, too. It also began to flash. 6 minutes. I hurried backward to the other end of the room, as far as I could, and ducked beneath a table. Then, closing my eyes, I pressed the activator. Nothing happened. I waited for 10 seconds, even though Lee said that it was supposed to go off within 3. The 10 seconds turned into 20, and then I could wait no longer. Dang it! Whether the cylinders were faulty to begin with, or the fault had something to do with the 2 cylinders that I dropped, I didn't know. I hurried back to the explosives and examined the wires, thinking that perhaps I hadn't inserted some properly. I thought I'd been so careful to check them, but now that I scrutinized them, one looked slightly out of place. On one of the cylinders that I'd dropped, the fitting had become loose. I needed to push the wire further inward, but that could cause the explosives to detonate too soon. I had no choice now. I gazed around the lab, looking for any kind of utensil that could assist me. I found a pair of longish tongs and grabbed them. Gripping the wire, I pushed inward. A beep sounded. It had worked. 3 flashed up on my activator's tiny screen. Adrenaline surging through my veins, I threw myself against the floor and tried to get beneath a table as the bombs erupted. Although I managed to duck beneath a steel table which bore the brunt of the blast and shattering glass, the billowing heat scorched my face and inflamed my porticue injuries. An alarm blared. 3 minutes. Coughing, I gripped the hem of my dress and pulled it up to cover my mouth and nose. I stood up and gazed at the explosion's aftermath. Setting off something like this in a lab was extremely dangerous. Lee had warned me of that. Any number of flammable substances could ignite at any moment now. That was why I had to grab the egg and get the hell out. I picked up a chair and planted it a few feet in front of me, using it as an island to draw closer to the unprotected egg, still perched in its stand, until I could lean over and close my hand around it, touching it for the first time. It was cool and sleek and heavier than I had expected it to be. My palms being sweaty didn't exactly help my grip around it, but I held onto it for dear life as I raced to the lab's exit. I dashed along the corridor back to the stairwell. I scaled the first flight of stairs. As I reached the second, I heard the second round of explosions higher up in the building. Lee hadn't been joking when he'd said I needed to get out in time. The door at the top of the stairwell was like a gateway to heaven as I reached it. I pulled down hard on the handle, pushing it open, and staggered out into the cool night breeze. I'd done it. I'd made it out alive. And now, where was Lee? I gazed around the rooftop, whose atmosphere was quickly clogging with smoke. Lee wasn't up here. Did something go wrong? Rotors whirred above me. My immediate fear was that it was one of Patris's helicopters called to the incident. I was sure they would arrive soon, but this was not one of them. This was something I wasn't even sure how to describe. It was a bizarre hybrid aircraft. Its body was a large motorcycle, long enough to fit four people. Above it, fixed to a thick pole that ran down the center of the motorcycle, were spinning rotors. And on either end of it, where the wheels should have been, were two square wooden boxes, big enough to fit two men. I guessed some kind of balancing mechanism. Sitting on the seat and clutching the handles was Lee. He was twisting the ladder to navigate the aircraft. This must have been what he had been working on all along in his garage, fixing his third spare motorcycle. I had assumed that by arranging transport for us, Lee had meant that Matris would have provided something. But no. All this time, he had been building an illegal aircraft in his basement. His engineer Chris had also broken the law. Lee must have bribed him well, and hidden the aircraft somewhere nearby in anticipation of tonight. Lee looked relieved to see me, to say the least. He lowered the aircraft within 2 feet of the ground. Clutching the egg with one arm, I hauled myself up onto the seat and sat behind him. "Hand me the egg," Lee said. I placed it on his lap. He carefully slid it into a basket at the base of his seat, keeping it protected with both feet. I wrapped my arms firmly around his waist as we took off. As we moved past the rooftop of the lab, my stomach flipped. As we flew over a sheer drop, I couldn't even see the ground because of the smoke, and certainly nobody could see us. Lee sped up. We had to get out of here before Patreon aid arrived. We headed firmly eastward, leaving the smoke-infested area. The river came into view, and Matris's border loomed in the distance. Screams and shouts still echoed in my head as I glanced back over my shoulder at the destruction we had left behind. Then my eyes dragged over the rest of the city and the looming mountains beyond. So long, Patris. So long.
Chapter 34. Lee and I had been quiet the whole journey. As we reached Matris's border, he hovered a little lower, closer to the tops of the building. When I realized we were headed straight for Queen Rena's palace, I asked, "Are you going to finally tell me what's in the egg or not?"
"Not," Lee replied, clipped. "I don't have permission. That doesn't change because we've crossed borders. You'll have to ask the Queen or Alistair and see if they'll reveal it to you. Alistair will have the key, and no doubt he'll want to verify the egg's contents are intact."
I ground my teeth. After everything I'd been through, I felt I was owed an explanation. I would ask Alistair when I next saw him.
When I'd spoken to him before we left for the banquet earlier this evening, he'd said that he and the Queen would be waiting to receive us on the highest floor of the palace, which was where the Queen's private residential quarters were. Passing over the wall of the palace compound, we flew to a circular landing pad on its roof and, with a shudder, touched down. My knees felt weak as I slipped off the seat, my bare soles touching the concrete. I still had my heels strung around my right arm. I shook them off, letting them fall to the floor.
"You don't have any spare shoes with you, do you?" I asked Lee. My shoulder bag was too small to hold much other than the tools.
Lee got off his motorbike and opened up the seat, pulling out a black backpack with a pair of shoes inside.
I did bring these, actually, in case something went wrong and we had to do some extra running.
They were my old shoes, the ones I arrived in Patras with. I gave my handbag, which I had no further use for, to Lee, who dropped it into the underseat compartment before I slipped the shoes on and tied up the laces. After snapping the seat shut, Lee turned his focus to a door 15 feet away. I was about to start walking toward it, but he caught my hand and held me back.
"Wait here with the egg," he said. "I need a private word with him first."
I stayed put as Lee disappeared through the door. I breathed in deep, gazing around at the sparkling lights of Matrix City. It felt so strange to be back. I suspected it would take a few days to erase Patras from my brain, to remember that I didn't legally require a man for anything anymore, that men were the ones who submitted to us. But I didn't feel as liberated as I should have. I was still feeling numb. I had several hours to wait until the Banuxa pain wore off. I would see what emotions flooded back to me then. Lee was longer than I had expected him to be. I wondered what he was talking about. Something about me? Finally, I heard footsteps returning up the stairwell. He emerged from the doorway, his bunched tuxedo jacket and bag over one shoulder, while stuffing black gloves into one pocket. His expression was serious as he said, "Okay, you can go down now. First door on your right after leaving the staircase. I'll fetch the egg." I ventured down the stairwell, which consisted of two flights of steps, through an open reinforced door, and into a long, quiet hallway. It was lined with embroidered silk carpets, and the high walls were bedecked with portraits of Queen Rena's family and lineage. I paused to gaze at her 7 daughters. They shared her features prominently, slanted brows and sharp cheeks. Their ages ranged from 7 to 26, all conceived via insemination, all female. Matrix's doctors had methods of maximizing the chances of conceiving a female, but they weren't always accurate. Abortion wasn't permitted in Matrix, however, not even of male children, so I suppose the queen must have gotten lucky. To my knowledge, abortion wasn't allowed in Patras either. I continued and stopped outside the first door on my right. It was half open. I knocked briefly before stepping inside a warmly lit library, bordered by towering cherry wood bookcases. My eyes fell on the round table in the center of the room. Surrounded by high-backed chairs, I could make out the Queen and Alistair sitting next to each other, backs toward me. I approached the table and circled it to greet them, only to lay eyes on 2 corpses. Their heads lolled over their chest, their backs slumped, their fronts drenched in blood. Etched across their throats were wide, still oozing gashes. I stood, paralyzed. I blinked hard and fast, wondering if it was a hallucination brought on by the drug. I touched Queen Rena's stiff shoulder. It wasn't a hallucination. It was real. A blood-stained knife lay in front of the bodies, a few centimeters away from a message that had been scratched into the wooden table's surface. "For the boys of Matrix." My veins turned to ice. "Lee!" I choked. "Lee!" I staggered out of the room and rushed to the staircase as I continued to call for him. My voice gained volume as I ascended the steps and caught the sound of whirring rotors. "Lee!" I screamed, leaping the final steps and bursting out onto the roof. Lee and his aircraft were already 4 feet in the air and soaring toward the edge of the building. "Lee! No!" His head tilted toward me, an almost apologetic expression on his face as he called down in a steady, steely voice. "I'm sorry, Violet. If we want truth in our world, some things must be done. And sacrifices must be made." His words barely registered in my brain. My mind couldn't make sense of what was happening. I had just walked in on the Queen and Alistair murdered, and now Lee was flying away with the egg. In a haze of panic, my throat clamped up. I could no longer even scream. Adrenaline then took over. His aircraft still being within reach, I lunged forward, and with a jump I'd hardly thought I was capable of, I grabbed hold of one of the bars that lined the aircraft's undercarriage just 3 seconds before it crossed the roof's perimeter. Thrust over a sheer drop of over 13 floors, I fought to maintain my grip on the bars as the aircraft dipped with my weight. Pulling my legs upward, I hooked them over another bar on the other side of the carriage, gaining a better hold while the aircraft continued to speed away from the palace. As I was on the verge of attempting to pull myself higher, Lee's heavy boot crashed down against my right hand. Bone cracked. Pain erupted from my middle finger and seared up my wrist. My right hand slipped. Hanging now only by one hand and my legs, I thrust my right arm toward a bar near the center of the undercarriage and forced my throbbing hand to wrap around it. As Lee moved to drive his boot down against my left hand, I could afford to relinquish my grip. I let go a second prior to his boot hitting the metal. Before he could withdraw it again, I clamped my fingers around his ankle and jerked downward with all the strength I possessed. I heard the scraping of his second boot against the motorcycle's uneven metal floor. He was sliding. Then, he was shrieking. He was falling, past me, way past me, down, down, down. And then, within the blink of an eye, he was lying spread-eagled on the pretty brick path that ran through the Queen's back garden, rigid and still. Chapter 35. The dose of Banoxapane Lee had given me wasn't strong enough to suppress the fear ripping through my chest. Clinging to the base of the aircraft, the blood rushing to my head as I gaped down at Lee's dead body, I felt paralyzed. I was barely even aware that the aircraft was continuing to soar ahead, unmanned. I was lost in the past, reliving every second of the last 10 minutes. What just happened? Why? Why did he do it? My sweating right hand, sliding on the bar, snapped me back to the present. I felt numb all over from shock, but I had to climb up onto the motorcycle unless I wanted to join Lee in the Queen's ornamental grounds. Gradually, I managed to maneuver my way upward, making use of my left hand over my right as much as I could, until I was perched on the motorcycle's seat, my feet planted firmly on either side of me. I gripped the base of my seat and gazed back at the increasingly distant palace. Lee's form fell out of my vision, the high wall bordering the palace concealing him. The aircraft no longer seemed to be ascending much, but it was hurtling forward with unnerving speed. I looked ahead of me, over the sprawling city and the suburbs beyond. Terror clawed at me. I had not the first clue how to navigate this thing. It was a wonder to me that it was even still flying, that it hadn't crashed to the ground the moment Lee fell out. Where am I going? What just happened? I didn't know how to start making sense of it. But what I did know was that I had to put as much distance between myself and that palace as possible, as fast as possible. I didn't know how long it would take for the Queen and Alistair's bodies to be discovered. I cursed myself for making so much noise when shouting for Lee. After discovering their corpses, I'd fallen into a stupor of disbelief and been so stupid as to place a hand upon the Queen's shoulder. A bare hand. I'd left behind my trace, and whoever discovered them would notice that the door that led up to the rooftop had been left open. They'd search the roof, notice Lee's body, if that hadn't been discovered beforehand, and realize I would be missing. I didn't know whether anyone else in that palace was aware of the mission Lee and I were supposed to be carrying out in Patras, whether they knew that we were due to return in Lee's makeshift aircraft. But if anyone did know, surely the first thing they would assume was that I had gone flying off with it. They'd send a horde of helicopters after me. This could be happening at any moment. My heart quivering, I fixed my eyes ahead and dared place my hands on the handlebars for support. How does this thing work? I'd caught a glimpse of Lee twisting the throttle while riding it, the way you would twist the throttle of a regular motorcycle. Was that action spurring the aircraft forward? Were any of the bike's other parts used for similar functions? The brakes for slowing? God, this is insane. Sweat dripped from my forehead as I mustered the courage to twist the throttle. The engine chugged. The rotors spun faster. The aircraft's speed increased. I blew out unsteadily. I'd figured out how to accelerate. Stopping and eventually landing would be another terrifying experience entirely. But I had no idea when I could stop or land. I couldn't anywhere in the city or in the suburbs. With the Queen's death, this entire area would soon be swarming with wardens. I had to go further, beyond the suburbs. The Queen. That was where I would reach if I kept moving. And then, once I reached the Green? Then what? What had Lee been thinking? Where had he been planning to head? Back to Patras? Was that where his loyalties really lay? Then why the hell would he agree to blow up the lab and attempt to kill the king in the process? He couldn't have been loyal to Patras, and I couldn't believe that he would head back there. He had been navigating northward, in the same direction I was going now. The Green. Where was Lee's backpack? I couldn't see it hanging anywhere. And, for that matter, where was the egg? That blasted egg. They must be in the compartment beneath my seat. Before I could even begin trying to formulate my next step, I had to attempt to figure Lee out. How could he have been playing both sides all along? And why? For the egg? Why did he want it? It struck me that he must have taken the key from Alistair before he murdered him. Hopefully it hadn't still been on Lee's person when he'd fallen. I threw another anxious glance over my shoulder. I could barely even make out the palace anymore. The city was slipping away beneath me, and soon so were the suburbs. I twisted the throttle, increasing the aircraft's speed further. Daring to stand, I unlatched the seat to reveal a much larger compartment than I'd expected to find. Shafts of moonlight escaping through the clouds revealed Lee's backpack, dozens of tins of food, bottles of water, 3 guns, 4 knives, 5 aerosol sprays, the same variety that Ms. Dale had brought with us to the Green, spare clothing, a flashlight, a breathing mask, thick gloves, and the egg, safely stowed in one corner. He had come prepared for the Green. I grabbed the flashlight and the backpack before closing the seat and resuming my sitting position. Switching on the light, I unzipped the main compartment and began to rummage in search of the key. Within it was another knife, a box of matches, a loop of rope, an unlabeled white tube of pills that looked suspiciously like binoxapane, a compass, a camera, and then 2 photographs. I removed the compass and placed it in a small holder that was fixed beneath the gears. Then I picked up the photographs and shone my light down on them. My breath hitched. One of them displayed an all-too-familiar sight, the table in the Queen's Library etched with the words, "For the Boys of Matris." The second displayed a different message. "For the men you will deceive," was scratched into the tinted windshield of a shiny gold sedan. It looked like King Maxon's vehicle. Perhaps Lee had scratched that message while it was pulled up in the lab's parking lot after the blast. We had parted ways on the ground floor. What does all this mean? What about the boys of Matris? Fear surged through me as I recalled Vigo's speculation. No, they can't be killing the marked ones. They can't be. As I drove deeper into the backpack, my fingers closed around a crumpled piece of paper. I pulled it out and flattened it. It was covered with smudged black handwriting. My mouth fell open as I began to read.
"Desmond, I regret what I will have to do. To Violet Bates, the criminal, Chris Patton, the engineer, Duncan Friedman, the arms specialist, Seb Morrissey, the camera technician, Jacob Venn, the immigration officer. But when we have the egg and its key, I will remember that each served their purpose. Sacrifices must be made. I imagine the furor I will have created in both nations tonight. I can't be sure that King Maxon will be killed, but Patris's prize lab will be shaken, and on Matris's side, the queen and Alistair will be wiped out, and neither nation will have the egg. It's possible Patris will piece together the puzzle and discover that the terrorist was not Viggo Croft, even if they consider my and Violet's sudden absence a casualty of the explosion. We will have hardly left a whole free trail. It doesn't matter. I don't give a damn whether a war sparks between the two nations on the back of my actions. Every step I've taken to conceal Violet's and my tracks and place the blame on Viggo has been mostly a front for Violet so that she continues to trust that I'm in line with Matris's wishes, as well as to satisfy Alistair, who continues to hound me for updates. Alistair intends for me to assassinate Viggo after he shows up at the lab, make it look like he committed the crime and then claimed his own life as some kind of statement. That would ensure Matrix's involvement being ruled out of the picture, but I won't bother with that, because, again, I don't care. As I've sensed Violet beginning to get more out of control, however, it's been important that I rein her in. She is still of use to me, and I need her obedience. I've tried to command it with affection, albeit half-heartedly. That's had no effect on her. I've had to control her by other means, like monitoring her with a tracker. And I'll feed her a pill. I think that will be needed in order for the night to run smoothly. God knows I've had enough obstacles already, but it will all come through in the end. I know it will. Patris believes me to be Patrian. Matris believes me to be Matrian. They don't know that I belong to neither. I am a man of no nation. Many people see that as a curse, but for me it's a gift. It's allowed me to perceive the world in a way that others can't. Others who are too embedded in the two systems to even consider a life beyond that which has been chalked out for them. I'm not sure how far back my discontent has dated with the two societies, perhaps as early as 8, but I remember the day I finally decided I needed to escape. It was only recently, soon after King Maxon's ascent to the throne, by some twist of providence, two incidents I haven't been able to ignore occurred within the space of a few days. I discovered the real reason King Maxon commissioned Benexapane, and the truth about the marked boys of Matris. Since the two incidents, it's simply been a matter of waiting for the right opportunity. If I'm going to escape, I want to leave with a bang, so to speak. I want to leave a mark on both nations. One neither will forget in a hurry. When the egg went missing from Matris, I saw my opportunity and seized it. The truth is, even I don't know what's within that sleek metal egg. All I know is that anything both governments want can't be a good thing for anyone, no matter how many self-serving lies they spout. And so, with this mission, I will be able to accomplish both objectives in one strike, mark and flee. Just as I will leave a note for Matris, I will also leave one for Patris. I don't know where I will head or if I will survive, if there is anything at all beyond that mass of forest. But even if the green is indeed as endless as people believe, if my aircraft gives way before I manage to cross it, and I never live to discover what lies beyond the trees, I don't care. I will have lived a fuller life in the past 24 hours than in all of my 25 years of living. I will die a free man, not a pawn in someone's game. Lee.
As I finished reading, my hands were trembling so hard I could no longer hold the paper straight. This strange letter exploded a dozen questions in my mind, but I could focus on only one. The boys. What had Lee discovered about the boys? Folding up the paper, I slipped it back into the bag, my heart palpitating. I continued to search through its contents. I discovered a small silver key in one of the side pockets. Retrieving it, I stood up again and opened the seat. I planted the backpack inside before reaching down to scoop up the egg. I placed it on my lap as I resettled. The keyhole was near the base. Attempting to still my hands, I managed to insert the key into the hole and twisted it clockwise. It moved 270 degrees before stopping. There was a click, and then a smooth crack appeared around the center of the egg. Drying my hands of perspiration against my ripped dress, I eased open the egg's lid and stared. Only the top half of the silver casing would unlatch, and it lifted to expose a second, smaller egg that fit snugly inside it. Its walls appeared to be made of some kind of extremely thick glass, and within it swirled a sack of liquid. The sack's wall was thick, spongy, and transparent. It stuck flush to the glass like it had been glued there. The liquid's texture was gooey and semi-transparent, its color brownish amber. I touched the exterior with my finger. It was warm, shockingly warm. The very bottom of the egg was taken up by a black plate, whose base was concave to fit the shape of the egg. I guessed that was some sort of temperature-controlling device. Shining my flashlight directly through the murky liquid, I spotted something else. It was small, smaller than the center of my palm. It looked like an embryo. What type of embryo exactly? I wasn't knowledgeable enough about biology to tell. It was still in early stages of development. I could make out the bulge of a head, the curve of a back, several bumps which I guessed would be limbs. A translucent cord was attached to its midriff. The cord connected the fetus to the center of the egg's base, that strange plate thing. What is this? Why do Matris and Patris want it so badly? What did Lee want with it? It could be an animal. It could be a human. A sudden gust of wind shook me out of my stupor. It was strong enough to wobble the aircraft. Given that I hadn't been holding on to anything for support, and I still couldn't with the egg in my hands, my feet shot outward over the floor to steady myself. In the process, my heel shifted a lever at the base of my seat that I hadn't even noticed. Two alarmingly loud creaks emanated from the wooden boxes fixed to either side of the motorcycle. I tensed up, petrified I'd done something fatal. What I was not expecting was for the bases of the wooden boxes to suddenly flap open and for four bodies to tumble out. Four male bodies. I almost choked on my tongue as I realized I recognized one of them. His faded dungarees, his gray speckled hair, his frozen, stubbled face. It was Chris, the mechanic. Hurtling down with the other three men to a quiet suburban street, they made contact with the concrete with a sickening splat. The other three men. They had to be the other three dots on Lee's monitor. Duncan, Seb, and Jacob. Lee was a madman. What was he doing carrying them in his aircraft? He must have murdered them shortly before the banquet and stored them in the boxes out of convenience. Maybe he'd been planning to dump them in the green. Clearly, I'd never known the real Lee. The flat, matrian male persona he'd put forward throughout my stay with him had been an act. Unable to focus on the egg any longer, I closed and locked it up before replacing it in the seat compartment with more care than I'd previously handled it. There was a life in that thing. After zipping up the key in the backpack, I sat down and faced forward. I gripped the handles for support. I felt like throwing up. Lee's letter replayed in my mind. Desmond. Why was it addressed to Desmond? That was one of the strangest things about the letter. Desmond was Lee's middle name. Perhaps the letter was some kind of journal entry, an upheaval of guilt before the night. But still, it didn't make any sense to me that he would use his middle name. Why not address it to Lee? He'd called himself only Lee around me, and I hadn't heard a single person address him as Desmond either. As I recall the explanation Lee had given me for the name, the very first night I arrived in Patris, a thought struck me. My full name is Lee Desmond Bertrand, named Lee by my father, Desmond by my mother.
I'm native to neither Matris nor Patris. In fact, I was born in the middle.
I drew my mind back to a question I had mulled over and posed to Vigo the evening we'd sat atop the roof in his backyard. What happens to someone who doesn't feel they belong in either nation? Lee's father was a Patrian. His mother, a Matrian. Lee of Patris, Desmond of Matris. A chill ran down my spine as I wondered if Lee truly was insane. Maybe he had some kind of split personality disorder. Maybe his childhood had messed him up. Maybe I finally had an answer to my question, and Lee was an extreme case of what could happen to a person who felt they belonged in neither nation. They rebelled against both. Suddenly, the night seemed to grow much colder. I shivered. I was beginning to near the green. Ms. Dale had been right. She'd told me, not far away from where I soared now, that once I reached the other side of the river, I should trust no one. I just hadn't considered Lee to be a member of the other side. Now, whether I liked it or not, I didn't belong to either side either. I was a fugitive from both nations, and I was sitting exactly where Lee would be sitting right now, on an illegal aircraft, accompanied by the egg, some meager supplies, and a few pieces of survival equipment. My eyes fell to the compass I'd placed in the holder. Lee had intended to head north, but my heart felt torn in two directions. North and west. My brother and Vigo. They were the only two people who mattered to me anymore. I felt like the world could implode, which it might do anyway after tonight's events. But if I could find those two alive, I would be content. But now I feared that both of them were already dead. Although Lee had decided not to kill Vigo earlier, for all I knew, he could have gotten caught up in the blast. Maybe Lee had set off more bombs on the ground floor than I was aware of. He'd seemed keen to destroy the building as much as possible. And for my brother? After Vigo's suspicion, and now Lee's words, I feared that Queen Rena had lied to me all along about a reunion. I had only a sliver of hope left in my heart that Tim was still alive. But somehow, I had to find out. My soul would not rest until I had. However many days or hours I had left to live after tonight's disaster, I had to make them count. I had nothing left to lose. I didn't know how I would pull off any of this, or in what order. I still barely knew how to navigate this darn aircraft. I didn't know how to change its direction, and I sure didn't know how to land. But whatever I ended up doing, and however I ended up doing it, there was one thing I knew for certain. From this moment on, like Lee Desmond Bertrand, I had to be a player of my own rules. No longer a pawn in someone's game.
Thank you for listening to The Gender Game by Bella Forrest. If you'd like to find out what happens next, Book 2, The Gender Secret, is available now on Audible, Amazon, and iTunes.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.